home is sanctuary. Home is family. It's safety. So what happens when that loss is not just individual, but community-wide? Psychiatrist Mindy Fully Love studies cities, and she has a term for what happens: root shock. She talked with Raymond Tangekar about root shock and explains why she believes so many of our cities are broken.
We came across root shock in interviewing people who had lost their neighborhoods, and there wasn't an accurate term to describe the scope of the losses that occur when people lose something as big as a neighborhood. And gardeners talk about root shock when you pull a plant out of the ground and then you rupture its tender root hairs and break its roots. And plants can go into shock if they're not moved in a considerate way. And we thought people went into shock, but also that the idea that you ripped the very roots that people have was a better way to conceptualize the magnitude of the losses that people go through when they lose a neighborhood. Often when governments are talking about displacing people, they say they will reimburse people for the cost of their homes. They don't reimburse for anything else. And it's all those other things, having neighbors who are helpful, having churches, schools, organizations, businesses, all of that fabric of community is badly damaged, and much of it is destroyed when neighborhoods are destroyed. And that's the root shock.
If you were to look at a neighborhood or a community like a living organism, and I suppose if we were to treat root shock as a disease, are there symptoms that you see at the community level?
In a neighborhood where people have lived for some decades and they've gotten to know each other and they've worked together, they develop close social connections, networks. And these networks solve all kinds of problems. They take care of the vulnerable. They help to raise the children. So the networks are crucial for the strength and the integrity of the community. When a neighborhood is destroyed, what you see in the aftermath is people struggling to take care of problems, but with fewer resources and more irritation. So you often see violence in the aftermath of community upheaval. You see teenagers getting into trouble. You see education achievement going down. So these are some of the things that happen as communities reorganize. That stabilizes after a while if communities are not disturbed again. They get back to normal. But it takes a while for communities to find each other and coalesce again.
Well, can we go into some of those policies that resulted in this kind of displacement?
The policies that we've studied and written about really begin with the institution of Jim Crow. The Jim Crow laws are basically enacted in the 1890s, and we are still in the Jim Crow period. We haven't undone those laws. That's when segregation comes to characterize how people live together. Segregation is intensified in the 1930s by the application of redlining policies. Redlining policies were implemented by the federal government and were used to describe who lived in what neighborhoods. They were stratified such that people who lived in relatively new housing and who were white and who had restrictive covenants, so non-white people could not move in, those were given a green rating, which encouraged lending and insurance. Whereas other places that had less restrictive covenants or allowed black people to live there were considered red and were places where they, you know, it was much more difficult to get a mortgage or to get insurance or to get any kind of outside investment for one's home.
And you've seen these maps and applications. I mean, it's not subtle. It's in very clear terms that certain groups were being privileged over others.
Yes, the maps and the supporting documents are in the National Archives, and anyone can go and see them. The supporting documents make clear the nature of the racist decisions that are being made. And they are essential for anybody who wants to understand racism and how it's operated in the United States. On the heels of redlining in 1949, we get urban renewal, which designated neighborhoods, and these often turned out to be neighborhoods that had been coded red by the redlining maps, as a blight on the city, and authorized cities to use eminent domain to take the buildings and clear the land and sell it to developers for higher uses. On the heels of that came policies of disinvestment, famously in New York City, called plant shrinkage. And on the heels of that came all of the myriad epidemics that drew my attention when I started to do research in 1986, including the AIDS epidemic and the crack epidemic. all of which were themselves redlined and not given public health dollars to be managed in the way that epidemics should be managed. So they wreaked havoc on the neighborhoods.
You referenced planned shrinkage. Could you briefly summarize what that is?
Planned shrinkage is a policy proposed in New York City that said New York City was losing population, therefore let's concentrate the population in some parts of the city and let the other land lie fallow until it was needed. And the way in which this policy was carried out in New York City was by removing fire stations from densely populated minority neighborhoods with very high levels of housing overcrowding. And this caused a firestorm of fires, which destroyed massive amounts of the housing in those neighborhoods. In the South Bronx, which was probably the worst hit, in some areas, 80% of the housing was destroyed.
So what's the solution then? I mean, as an individual, how could I help to revitalize a neighborhood responsibly?
I've had the opportunity to learn about the work of people that I think are really focused on this process of fracturing the American city. And from that, I identified 9 elements of urban restoration. The first one, which is in many ways the most critical, is the idea that if you want to solve the problems of neighborhoods, you have to look at the whole city. You have to keep the whole city in mind. And this is really an important shift in our thinking, because we tend to say that neighborhood over there, say Harlem, has problems, without looking at how did Harlem get to have problems and what are the dynamics in the whole city. When we start to look at it more holistically, then we really start to look at the policies in the city that are causing problems, and we start to think what might the solutions be at the policy level and in terms of our own investments.
You've been doing this for decades now, and to be honest, you're up against some really daunting odds, right? I mean, you're working to overturn systems and entrenched ways of thinking and social policies that go back much farther into our nation's history. And so I guess I'm wondering how you stay motivated. What prevents you from giving in to that creeping suspicion that, you know, that real change is impossible?
I know that real change is possible. Much of the real change I'm seeing is negative, but it's real change and it's driven by people. So, for example, I'm seeing global warming. That's a real change. And I'm seeing growing inequality, and that's a real change. So I know change can happen. And the trick is, how do I get it to happen in a way that I think will be better for the health of most people? And I also, you know, take great comfort from the work of Miles Horton, who founded a school for organizers. He said that when you set a goal for your life, you shouldn't set a goal of something you can accomplish in your lifetime. You should set a goal of something that you won't accomplish, but just work at it every day. He was one of the people who helped Rosa Parks, and she was at the Highlander School in the summer before she refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus, which triggered the great Montgomery bus boycott and helped to dismantle the segregation laws. So I think his advice has already helped America, and I take his advice very seriously.
Mindy Foley-Love is the author of Urban Alchemy, Restoring Joy in America's Sorted Out Cities. Raymond Tankekar talked with her.